From NPR News, this is the podcast of the best of weekends and all things considered. The highlights from our shows this past weekend. I'm Guy Raz, the host of the program Saturday and Sunday. This episode, the anti-tax crusader Grover Norquist finds inspiration from Coca-Cola, his brand for the Republican Party, never raise taxes.
When you raise taxes, the politicians spend the money.
Also, using digital technology to recreate an animal sound lost to history. Apparently, that's a woolly mammoth. And later, how the Church of Scientology keeps its members in line.
Would they release that information if somebody like Cruz or Travolta decided to leave and denounce the church? That I think, is a credible fear.
Plus, America's Broet Laureate on writing poetry for dudes.
Why do buses smell? The young girl asks her mother. I listen because I want to know, too.
And going deep with party rockers LMFAO.
Party is deeper than the word party.
Those stories plus sounds of the summertime, that's all coming up. The man many Democrats believe is the main obstacle to a deal over raising the debt ceiling doesn't even hold elected office. His name is Grover Norquist, and he heads the powerful lobby group Americans for Tax Reform. More than 95% of congressional Republicans have signed Norquist's Taxpayer Protection Pledge. It's an ironclad commitment to oppose any and all new taxes. Norquist's influence on the Republican Party cannot be overstated, something even the president made passing reference to last night when he described the letters he receives from ordinary American citizens.
For us to be more worried about what some funder says or some talk radio show host says or what some columnist says or what pledge we signed back when we were trying to run or worrying about having a primary fight. For us to be thinking in those terms, instead of thinking about those folks, is inexcusable.
I talked with Grover Norquist yesterday, and he denies that he's the primary reason why Republicans won't compromise on taxes.
The pledge is out there, frankly, independent of me. I introduced candidates to it, but it's between incumbent office holders and their voters. I mean, if I got hit by a truck, they would still have to get reelected by the people they previously got reelected to, promising not to raise taxes. I facilitated putting them together.
Yeah, but, I mean, you could, of course, put resources into an opposition candidate or another candidate in a primary.
If somebody breaks the pledge or votes for tax increases, we would very much like to highlight to voters the position of that candidate. That's true.
And that, of course, worries some congressional Republicans. They don't want you to go after them.
Well, yes, but if you look at who's in Congress right now, they're not against taxes because I asked them to. They're not against taxes because they think that's the politically popular thing to do this week. These are true believers. These are people who ran for office because they thought the government was too big.
But against tax increases in all cases, absolutely no compromise.
No net tax increase, yes. As long as there was a tax cut of the same size and the same duration in the same bill.
Almost every economist, as you know, Grover Norquist, and the Blue Ribbon Simpson-Bowles Commission says you can't even begin to tackle the issue of the federal debt without some combination of spending cuts and some tax increases. I mean, do you think they're wrong?
Yes, I certainly disagree. It can only be done through spending restraint.
Only through spending cuts.
Right. If you raise taxes, we know the politics of it is when you raise taxes, the politicians spend the money. You cannot reduce the size of government while increasing taxes. Spending has to come down, leave taxes.
It's about starving the beast.
Well, it's about not feeding the beast and encouraging him that he doesn't have to quit.
What do you think the average taxpayer should expect from the government in return for paying the taxes that you think that they should pay?
Well, as a taxpayer advocate and somebody for limited government, I take the same approach that Samuel Gompers took as an early labor leader mm-hmm. when businessmen would go, come, what do you want? And his answer was more. Okay, more this year. Next year, ask me, I want more. The year after that, I want more. What do I want? I want less government spending and lower taxes. And next year, less. And the year after that, less. I'm a Fabian small market guy. I'm not interested in cutting the government in half tomorrow. I think that's a silly way to try and cut back the cost of government. Let's look at those things that are least constructive, those things that are damaging rather than helpful. So there are a lot of things we can do that reduce the cost and scope of government. We can also stop growing the government in new and different areas. I'm not in favor of taking some meat cleaver to government spending, but we can shrink it and certainly don't throw more cash at it to expand.
If there is no deal, say, and the country goes into default, some people will say it's because of the anti-tax pledge that so many congressional Republicans have signed. Would you feel responsible in any way? Economists are suggesting this could result in an economic crisis.
I think it'd be a big mistake to go into default, and I do not believe that whatever his left-of-center ideological views are, that Obama will allow his desires for tax increases to have him close the government down rather than sign a deal that just cuts spending. So I don't think Obama is more committed to tax increases than he is to the good of the country.
Okay, but if it did happen, you would not feel responsible in any way.
Obama would be responsible. He's the guy vetoing a plan.
That's Grover Norquist. He heads Americans for Tax Reform and is the author of the Taxpayer Protection Pledge. It's been signed by 95% of congressional Republicans. Grover Norquist, thank you.
Good to be with you.
Now, when animals do become extinct, one thing that's lost forever is their sound. Very little science is actually dedicated to the sounds that animals make, and almost nobody tries to preserve those sounds. But producer Brent Bachman spoke to one artist who is trying to change that.
Hello, London.
Hi, how are you?
Margaret Humeau just graduated from the Royal College of Art in London.
2 weeks ago.
Congratulations.
Yeah, thank you.
This past year at school, she's been working on a project to reconstruct the voice boxes of extinct animals. Here's the problem with reconstructing your standard voice box. It's made of soft tissue. So unlike bones, it doesn't fossilize. But Margaret thought maybe there could be another way.
So actually, I started with Lucy.
You know, Lucy.
It's the first chimpanzee which started to walk, so it's considered as the first human.
And to recreate her voice, Margaret got a hold of Lucy's skeletal records to accurately reconstruct the resonance cavities in her skull. She even spoke to the surgeon who performed only the second successful human larynx transplant on a woman in California earlier this year.
Actually, he told me this very funny story that I was thinking she would get the voice of the donor.
Of someone else, right.
Yeah, and actually she recovered her own voice, meaning that the specificity of the voice doesn't come from the larynx itself, but from the way you shape air in your lungs and the way it resonates in your resonance cavities. So it meant I was on the right track.
She met with paleontologists, even an ear, nose, and throat doctor. and using resin, silicone, and rubber, she set to work rebuilding Lucy's voice box. Yeah.
Because what makes the difference between a human voice and an animal sound? The difference is the brain, so they don't, we think before we talk. I mean, for most people.
Yeah. This is Lucy. The hissing you hear is a pressurized air tank blowing air through her reconstructed vocal cords. Remember those model body parts you used to take apart in school? It kind of looks like that, hooked up to a big air tank.
So I'm quite happy because it has the pitch of a human, but then it's still a roar. You can hear the vibration of it's like an animal's voice.
But Margaret wanted to go bigger. She settled on a woolly mammoth. It's got a relative in the modern elephant, so she figured anatomically there'd be some reference data. Again, she met with more experts.
Yeah, then I met zoologists, veterinarians.
She redesigned the mammoth's vocal cords. They're 8 inches wide. She built artificial lungs, resonance cavities modeled after its skull, its windpipe. The whole thing is about 20 feet long. This is Margaret's mammoth. It might not have sounded exactly like this. Aside from scientists, she also met with the guy who advised Steven Spielberg on the dinosaur sounds in Jurassic Park. But you do feel a presence listening to it. For that, Margaret says she owes French explorer Bernard Bix, who she calls her biggest help.
He has actually been able to touch these animals. They are completely preserved. And so he told me about, the smell of them and being able to touch the fur of a mammoth which had been living 10,000 years ago.
Is it true that there were children in the exhibit who would run and get scared?
I read that on internet. I haven't seen them, but I would have loved. That was the whole purpose, so...
That's Marguerite Humeau. She spoke to our producer, Brent Bachman. Starting tomorrow, you can see and hear her recreation of the voice of Lucy at the Museum of Modern Art in New York. Our book today traces the rapid rise of Scientology, and it starts in the late 1940s when L. Ron Hubbard, a pulp fiction and fantasy writer, decided to try something new.
Early in the winter of 1949, L. Ron Hubbard wrote to his literary agent, Forrest Ackerman, to tell him that he was preparing a manuscript of brilliance. The book would be so powerful, Hubbard joked, that a reader would be able to rape women without their knowing it, communicate suicide messages to their enemies as they sleep, evolve the best way of protecting or destroying communism, and other handy household hints. He wasn't sure what to title his book, perhaps something along the lines of Science of the Mind. This has more selling and publicity angles than any book of which I have ever heard, he said.
The book would be called Dianetics, the Modern Science of Mental Health, and it would form the basis for a new religion, Scientology. Journalist Janet Reitman, whose voice you just heard, writes about this episode and others in her new book, Inside Scientology, The Story of America's Most Secretive Religion. Reitman spent more than 5 years researching L. Ron Hubbard, the church, and its current and somewhat controversial leader, David Miscavige.
When he was 16 years old, he decided to join their management, which is called the Sea Organization, and it is populated with children of Scientologists, and it's a kind of a paramilitary-style organization. And he, over the years, rose to a position of power. He was a very shrewd guy, kind of a tactician type. So when Hubbard died, Miscavige was in the position with a couple of other people to kind of take over the church, and then he maneuvered so that he rose to be the ultimate power.
And people have described him as a tyrannical leader to you.
Yes. They've described him as tyrannical, as sadistic. There are a long list of adjectives.
He, of course, still is the head of the church,
yes.
But he has been successful in, for example, getting tax-exempt status for the church, fighting off an IRS inquiry in the late 90s. So he has actually been a successful leader, you could argue, for the Church of Scientology, right?
He's been successful in certain ways. I mean, he's obviously gained legitimacy for the Church of Scientology as a church. He has, you know, given it a certain mainstream appeal. On the other hand, he has made Scientology itself very rigid. And within the management of Scientology, he's imposed an incredibly punitive system where people basically live in fear of him, especially those who work and live on what they call the international base, which is in the California desert, and it's where that's kind of the headquarters in a way of the church. That's where Miscavige is. That's where all the top executives are.
And you actually had an opportunity to go out there a few years back with a man named Mike Rinder, who at the time was the chief spokesman for the church and a major source for your book. He is no longer an official member of the church. Does he consider himself to be a Scientologist?
Oh, absolutely. Mm. Mike Rinder and another guy named Marty Rathbun, who was the number two in the church for many years, and Rinder was about number three, they have left the Church of Scientology.
In part because of David Miscavige.
In full because of David Miscavige, without giving up a shred of their belief in Scientology or in L. Ron Hubbard. And they've started essentially a reform movement. They call themselves the Independents. They are trying to reform Scientology from the outside and have attracted a following of people who were very disenchanted with the organization but still want to do Scientology, still believe in it.
But the church under David Miscavige, who has been called the Pope of Scientology, they regard them as heretics. They basically have been excommunicated, right?
Yeah, they have been excommunicated.
I'm speaking with journalist Janet Reitman. Her new book is called Inside Scientology, The Story of America's Most Secretive Religion. Janet, a lot of people who know a little bit about Scientology, or even nothing at all, know, of course, about Tom Cruise and John Travolta and Kirstie Alley, the celebrities, right? And we know that there's always been a push to bring celebrities in. L. Ron Hubbard was interested in opinion makers and opinion shapers. There have always been rumors that, you know, you've heard and I've heard that with some celebrities, Scientology sort of holds a kind of pull and sway over them because they have their secrets. They know things about them that those celebrities don't want to be made public.
Yes. Well, there's a form of auditing.
Auditing is like?
It's counseling. Mm. That form of auditing, it's called a security check. And it exists to make sure that members are on the right track and are not thinking negative thoughts or not being influenced by negative outside influences. And so between the confessionals themselves and these security checks, the members reveal a tremendous amount of personal information, and they have to write this stuff up, and they also will be said verbally. And so that stuff is all basically filed away. The innermost secrets, the most personal secrets, are part of the record of the Church of Scientology. And, would they release that information if somebody like Cruise or Travolta decided to leave and denounce the church? That I think, is a credible fear.
You consider L. Ron Hubbard to be one of the most effective hucksters of his generation. And I'm wondering, after spending so much time with Scientologists and ex-Scientologists, who clearly the religion or the belief system has benefited many people, does it do any harm to the rest of us?
I think that's a really complicated question.
It gets criticized a lot, and it's easy to kind of bash Scientology as sort of a weird thing. But, I mean, if it doesn't hurt anybody, what's the problem?
I don't see it as threatening in any way, really, to the public. But what I do think is kind of worrisome is that they take a very harsh stance against psychiatry and psychiatric drugs. Scientology is, like, militantly against that.
They believe that psychiatrists are behind the Holocaust.
Yes, they do. They basically believe that psychiatrists are the root of all evil. And they've lobbied very aggressively against psychiatry, against prescription of psychiatric drugs. And they also claim to be experts at drug rehabilitation. And they have a number of drug rehab clinics called Narcanon. However, they have no 28-day time limit. And I'm not sure that alternative is workable. I think that alternative can be very harmful depending on how far you go with it. Mm-hmm. And that's what I think is threatening.
That's Janet Reitman. Her new book is called Inside Scientology, The Story of America's Most Secretive Religion. It's in bookstores now. Janet Reitman, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
We contacted the Church of Scientology for comment, and the Public Affairs Office sent an 11-page response. Part of that correspondence said, quote, "Ms. Reitman's book is filled with inaccuracies. It is neither scholarly nor well-researched and bears no resemblance to an inside story." You can read the Church's full statement at our website, npr.org. My next guest says he's created something groundbreaking in the world of poetry. Brian McGacken calls it broetry, poetry for bros. Here's how he describes it.
Broetry originated centuries ago high atop the mountains of feudal Japan, when a small sect of samurai monks decided they were tired of writing poems that were deep and meaningful and opted instead to write something people might actually enjoy. Okay, I made all that up. Broetry is poetry for dudes. It's poetry for people who don't like poetry. Had a rough day, feel like sitting down and relaxing, but only have a few minutes before the girlfriend gets back from Pilates? Broetry. Broetry is poetry for the 21st century. Broetry speaks to every man, woman, and dude child who understands that reading shouldn't have to be a chore. If you think you don't like poetry, you just haven't found a poem that's right for you. Broetry is poetry that's right for you. Broetry is a literary chili cheeseburger.
Brian McGacken calls himself America's Broet Laureate. He's got a master's in poetry from USC, and to everyone's surprise, he's the first in his class to land a book deal. And that book? It's a collection of broems, poems for bros, called Broetry. We asked him to share a few of them, starting with a haiku, "Why Do Buses Smell?"
Why do buses smell? The young girl asks her mother. I listen, because I want to know too. He's in Miami. This is probably the only completely true broem in the book. Every word of this is true. He's in Miami. Just in case the Los Angeles Police Department is looking for information on the whereabouts of a crafty-looking Latino male, age 30, about 5'10", and extremely skinny, who likes to smoke pot a lot and play video games all day, and who enjoys drinking Newcastle, Guinness, and high quantities of vitamin water, in the interest of any ongoing drug-related crimes in the area, for example, illegal possession, illegal sale, or illegal production in his friend's apartment in Los Feliz, he's in Miami. If you manage to track him down, please let me know. He owes me rent, 2 bottles of Arizona green tea, and a frozen pizza. Supreme, please.
Are there any sort of like broetic forebears, you know, in the world of broetry?
Yeah, there are a lot of poets who had broetic qualities. Frost liked baseball. He wrote about sports. His poetry was always very accessible. Even Shakespeare. Shakespeare was just writing about chicks. The cover poem is certainly an homage to William Carlos Williams.
The one on the cover of the book.
Yeah, the cover reads, "I have finished the beer that was in the icebox, and which you were probably saving for Friday. Forgive me, this girl came over, so sweet and so hot." Why you should listen to classical music. Two words, John Williams. Jaws, Superman, Indiana Jones. When Darth Maul gets chopped in half, spoiler alert, Obi-Wan is grooving to some classical music. I know what you're thinking, though. That movie came out in 1999. That's not classical music. First, do you know what a leitmotif is? Second, little Johnny Love is like 80 years old. Classical music. Did you know he composed the music for 4 separate Olympic Games and the theme song to Lost in Space? It's ridiculous. Classical music. It makes you smarter. And admit it, you could be more cultured. You just picked up a book called Broetry.
That's America's Broet Laureate, Brian McGacken. His new book of broems, poems for bros, is called Broetry. Brian, thanks, bro.
Thank you.
Time now for music. Party rock is in the house tonight. Everybody just have a good time. This is the number one song in America right now. Everybody just have a good time. Clap. Party rock is in the house tonight. It's called Party Rock Anthem by LMFAO, and it reached number one in Denmark, New Zealand, Mexico, Ireland, Sweden, Australia, Germany, Brazil, the UK. Okay, you get the point. This song is huge. It's the song of the summer. And the duo behind LMFAO, the aforementioned party rockers, are Stefan and Skylar Gordy, respectively the son and grandson of the legendary Berry Gordy, founder of Motown Records. Stefan is better known as DJ Redfoo, and Skylar performs as DJ Sky Blue. They're with me from our studios in Southern California. Gentlemen, welcome to the program.
What's up? What's up? What's up?
So I think it's safe to say this is officially the song of the summer. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Number one song on the Billboard charts.
Yeah.
Did you guys know that you were writing a number one song before you put it out there?
Our goal was we got to get to number one. But at the same point, I still feel slightly surprised.
Yeah.
But the goal was to, you know, make the world shuffle and change the world.
Okay, Redfoo, you are the son, and Sky Blue, you are the grandson of Berry Gordy, the founder of Motown. So that makes you guys uncle and nephew, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so Berry Gordy, that's some serious lineage. Mm. You guys must have grown up around legends like Smokey Robinson, The Temptations, Michael Jackson. I mean, were they coming in and out of your world?
Yeah, they were like normal characters to us. I mean, me and Smokey playing backgammon, you know. All the stars of Motown, Diana Ross and everybody, they were all so nice. And I feel like it taught us behind the scenes how to be towards people when we got into this position.
Have you guys had feedback from Dad and in Sky Blue's case, grandfather from Berry Gordy? I mean, what does he think about the record?
Oh, he loves it.
He performs with us.
Yeah,
does he?
He performs. He's we got him spraying champagne, and he loves shuffling. He loves Party Rock Anthem. He says it's his new workout, and you know he's learned the dance, and he's got his own variation, the Berry Gordy shuffle.
I have to say, the video to this song, Party Rock Anthem, it's a total homage to Thriller, Michael Jackson's Thriller. Can you guys describe this video?
Sure. It's got zombies. It's got dancing.
You have to basically dance to this music so the zombies won't think that you are actually a human and then bite you, right?
Exactly.
Right. It's amazing.
Exactly. It's to survive. We have to.
You've got
to
dance the Party Rock
Anthem.
You've got to do the Melbourne Shuffle.
Exactly.
What is the Melbourne Shuffle that I've been reading so much about?
It really all originates from the Charleston.
How do you do the Melbourne Shuffle?
The Melbourne Shuffle is a mix between the Running Man and sort of like a sidestep Charleston.
Huh.
And now you have the Party Rock Shuffle, which is just the way we're doing it in the video and stuff.
So your name, LMFAO, what's it stand for?
Laughing My Bleeping Ass Off.
How'd you come up with that?
Sexy Dudes was our name for a while.
Sexy Dudes, right.
First, you know, and our friends didn't like it, and so we had to ask one of our advisors, you know, Grandma Goodfoot 22.
Party advisor.
Which is Sky's grandma.
His real grandma.
His real grandma. We were on Instant Messenger, and we simply asked her, what do you think of our new name, Sexy Dudes? And she simply replied, LMFAO. Are you serious?
And from there, the name was, that was it.
There it was.
That's Stefan Gordy and Skylar Gordy. They're better known as DJ Redfoo and DJ Sky Blue. The duo make up the electro hip hop group LMFAO. Their album's called Sorry for Party Rocking, and their track, Party Rock Anthem, is the number one song in the United States at the moment.
Damn right.
Redfoo, Sky Blue, thanks so much.
thank you,
brother.
And finally this evening, a little relief from a week of scorching hot weather across large parts of the country. The National Weather Service says cooler temperatures are coming this week. At one point this past week, more than 130 million people were under a heat advisory. And while most people avoided the misery and stayed in cool air conditioning, some decided to take advantage of the heat. Here now, some of the sounds this past week of a country trying to stay cool.
Spring, and here she comes back.
get a strawberry milkshake?
Yep.
My name is Michaela Rice. I'm out here with my family at Riverside Park having a good time. Yeah, it's hot. The temperature's set to the HE double hockey stick.
There we have delicious peach banana smoothies with peaches from our farm. We throw in some cran apple juice, some ice.
Yum. It's pretty good. It's nice and cool. Very refreshing as we're all melting away today. I'll take two.
Katie went, and I am from New Orleans. I used to live in Illinois a while ago, but I was shocked. I didn't even know that Chicago had a beach. Pretty nice. We took the train here. It's a great day out. Brody, he's five. He's having fun. He's enjoying his time out here.
I'm Carol Dolder from Indianapolis, Indiana. We are sailing on our sailboat 23-foot O'Day on Eagle Creek Reservoir.
The song is Hot Fun in the Summertime by Sly and the Family Stone, along with the sounds of summer at Riverside Park in downtown Indianapolis, the beach at Lake Michigan in Chicago, a farmer's market in State College, Pennsylvania, and kids at play in Puffer's Pond in Amherst, Massachusetts. Thanks for listening to this edition of Weekends and All Things Considered. The program this week was directed by Petra Mayer and produced by Kenya Young, Phil Harrell, Lauren Silverman, Lily Percy, Brent Bachman, Megan Kane, and Kevin Lasky. Melissa Marquis is our technical director. Rick Holter is our senior editor. And our senior producer is Matt Martinez. I'm Guy Raz. Remember, you can always catch the entire program on your local public radio station in most places at 5 p.m. each Saturday and Sunday. We're back with a brand new podcast next weekend. Thanks for listening.